Hello, everyone. Friends from many corners of the continent and another continent as well. It's always a pleasure to be with you, to take this moment together. New faces, old faces, familiar faces, unknown faces. And as I was sitting just now, there came I was sitting with a quote that Geno Roshi had used in a Dharma talk when we were in Holland, in the Netherlands, for the transmission of BART in August. And I've kind of been sitting with that quote as a kind of like a koan since then. And my intention is not to talk about that quote, but that while sitting with the quote, one part of it is when it is known, mind itself is like space. That's the first line of the quote. And so when I was sitting with that, whenever I sit with that, there's this kind of deep eventually when I'm sitting with it, there is this deep, what I call in English, gladness. In French, we might say félicité. I don't know what you would say in Portuguese. You probably have something similar to félicité, no? In Spanish, I have no idea, but it's probably similar to Portuguese. I don't know. And it's not happiness, as opposed to sadness. It's just a very deep, it comes from the stillness and the letting go of ideas and just being, right? Something like that. And I maybe I will go into this more, but I say that because during the weekend I was with my fellow successors of Geno Roshi. We had a successors meeting here in next door to my house at the Dana Center. We meet once a year like that in person. And someone during the meeting had a picture of some of us who did Jukai together. Not all of us were in the picture, but seven of us received Jukai 30 years ago. September 19th was 30 years ago. And someone had this picture that wasn't from 94. It was probably from 96, a couple years later. And I immediately, when I looked at the picture, I immediately connected. The same thing came up for me. This gladness, this peace. This peace, this kind of stillness came up. And when I saw that, I realized that that is what has been and still is the common thread of my practice through all of these years. And as you know, we're celebrating our 20th year of White Flower and going through all those pictures too, the same thing is present for me. And even though there are times when it hasn't been easy, when I've gone through dark moments, difficulty, ups and downs, complications, it doesn't mean that everything has been good and perfect and happy, but underlying it all is this very basic stillness and gladness, something like that. Which has to do with the stillness and the putting the mind to rest. In Zen, we have this great koan, which involves Bodhidharma, who had met the emperor, and then, which is also a famous koan, and then he fled and went to the mountains. And as they say, he sat in a cave by himself for a certain amount of time, depending on how we interpret the story. Sometimes it's 9 days, sometimes it's 9 years. Let's just say it was a good stretch of time that he sat there. And while he was there, someone who had heard about him followed him, came. Actually, there's a story that a number of people followed him, and that among them was the emperor's daughter, and that the group of people who followed him eventually became his successors. One of them was supposedly the emperor's daughter, but her name was not included in the patriarchy of the successors. But historians have, there's some indication of this. In any case, this one fellow, Eka, who became his first successor, was desperate, burning desire to practice and know what this practice is about and to, get to the bottom of whatever his question was about his existence. We can all relate to that to some extent because we all have similar stories, different degrees of urgency, but something keeps bringing us back. It may not be, because we're suffering deeply. It may be just some kind of dissatisfaction. It may be that we really like this feeling of gladness that comes when we sit, and we can become addicted to that. Or we just maybe it's not so much an addiction, but that's how what we want to give our life to, at least for the time when we come to the retreat or come to a talk. This is what we choose to be present with at this moment. Well, Eka was much more, it was to a greater degree, and he followed Bodhidharma to the cave in the winter, and it was snowing and it was cold, and Bodhidharma would not come out, would not answer him, until finally the legend goes that Eka cut off his arm to show his determination. It's always interesting to look at that and say, well, what does that really mean? Is this a parable? What did he cut off to show his determination? Was it really his arm? In any case, he cut off something. He cut from something in order to show his determination. And so Bodhidharma finally came out and said, okay, so what do you want? And Eka said, my mind is not at rest. My mind is not at peace. Please, I beg you, put my mind to rest. This too, this can we recognize something in that of our own quest? We're seeking, seeking, seeking. We want to know something. We want to not feel the dissatisfaction or the unhappiness or frustration or anger. We don't want to react in the same way all the time. We want to know why there is this just terrible, terrible suffering and violence in our world today, and we're looking and we're seeking and we want answers. So we come to a guide, a teacher, and we ask. So Eka's question was basically his mind was not at rest. His mind was not quiet. And he asks Bodhidharma to quiet it for him. So Bodhidharma very kindly said, okay, bring me your mind and I will put it to rest for you. So Eka goes off and looks. This is what we do, right? We sit on our cushions and we look. A lot of the time, we're caught up in our chatter and our discussions with ourselves and with others and trying to resolve something, trying to acquire, obtain, become. But sometimes we have this little moment when we don't do that. And we can stop and say, wait, what am I doing here? And we can look then. With koan practice, that's what we do. You know, these stories are pushing us to come to that moment of looking into just this. Dogen said, turn the light inside. This other quote from Roshi is, know the mind itself. So Eka looks around and comes back. And Bodhidharma says, okay, so, and Eka says, I've looked everywhere. I can't find my mind. And Bodhidharma said, I have put your mind to rest for you. And at this moment, Eka has great realization. Eka has stopped looking. He's looked, he can't find it. He's entered what we, Bernie Glassman would say, not knowing, let's say. He has become familiar with the mystery, with the not knowing, with the unknown, which is what we are asked to do when we sit on our cushions. We are asked to meet this moment, which is completely unknown. If we really stop, if we really look into it. And so when I said, when I was sitting and this came up, this gladness, that's what the feeling is when I have, when my mind is quiet, something like that. It's connecting with the joy of being or something, even if it's in the middle of difficult circumstances. I sometimes give the example more recently of when I, more recently, 4.5 years ago now, but almost 5 years, when I became very ill with COVID. And it was a time of great unknowing. Nobody knew anything about this disease or what people were dying all over, and the hospitals were overflowing, and there was a lot of fear and rumors and things. And I truly did not know if I was going to live or die. Any ordinary sickness, the flu or something that I was familiar with, I would have said, okay, this is bad. I feel just terrible, but, I know that I'm going to turn the corner and come out of it. I didn't know. I really didn't know. And nobody around me knew. And I went through various stages of fear, desperation, anger. Why is this happening to me? Why is it not happening to other people? Of course, it was happening to a lot of other people too, but not really anyone close around me. How can this be happening to me? This very ego-centered response of me? How can this happen to me? Of all people, how could this happen to me? This isn't supposed to happen to me. I'm in good health. I'm not old. I, really take care of myself. I do everything right, And then at one point, it shifted. And the realization that, so we sometimes use the jargon of it's just this, letting go of wanting things to be different, because that's what causes most of our problems is we want things to be other than the way they are. So not wanting it to be different, kind of a total, absolute acceptance of the way it is. Free of hope. So no hope of dying or not dying or something like that. And the real basic thing that was real liberation was I'm just like everyone else. So it's this recognition of I too will die, or something like that. Although I was not dying, but I didn't know if I would, but there was this just total recognition of that. I'm just, like Miguel's name, a true woman of no rank. No rank, just nothing exceptional. And, this is after 20 years of practice when I didn't, I had had many realizations of not being special. And yet there's always another and another and another. And this was another in a different circumstance. Suddenly, the world had never been more beautiful. Life had never been more wonderful. And here I am, stuck in my bed for a month and a half, not knowing if I'm going to die. And suddenly, I connected again with that very profound gladness. And I could truly appreciate the beauty of the world. And deeply touched by all of the, there was so much conflict and debate and argument and so much strife around this disease and everything that was happening in the world. And even people trying to be happy, I could see outside my bedroom window. The French lockdown was really serious. You couldn't even go out and play. The children had to, they couldn't go and play in the park next door, right? They played in the parking lot behind their building, which I could see from my window, my bedroom window. And the adults would go and do their jogging around the parking lot. And there was a guy who used to he had this whole workout that he made for his whole family, and they all did it. And then the teenagers would go out in the afternoon and sit on the roof of the garage. And, just watching this, the whole human drama unfold, it was this deep, deep compassion. And the bittersweet mixture of sadness and gladness, or something poignant, sorrow and gladness, the poignancy of it, of the human desire to be happy and immortal. And because I had gone through the whole process myself, it was so real, it became my experience. So that's another version of this gladness I'm talking about. But this, it was the same gladness in the picture from 30 years ago that I experienced, that I recognized from that moment, although at that time I wouldn't have identified it in the same way. The same gladness that I experienced just a half an hour ago, sitting here with you on this computer screen, the same gladness that I have speaking to you at this moment. Someone said, because I do a lot of translation, and João, who also does translation, and Joa as well, could maybe relate with this. Someone said that translation is, it's like a text that we are going to translate is a flower that it's a bud of a flower. And the translator's task is to make that flower bloom in the mind of the reader who can't read the original language. And so, as a translator, I totally recognize that. And as in this position that I have as a supposed Zen teacher, because there's not really anything to teach. It's like the translator is not inventing anything. It's just relaying the text in a language so that others can understand it. In this position that I have with you of talking, it's the same thing. So I'm sharing with you, sometimes we share a method. So koans, that's a method. And then I sometimes describe what is possible if we apply that method in my experience. Of course, you have to make that flower in your own life. I try to make flower the bud of the method and the description so that it can then flower in you as well. So when I talk about this gladness, félicité, that's it. I'm presenting you with this bud, and then I'm describing how it became a flower for me, and I'm handing you the bud. Or, and it's interesting in one of the koans as well. We have the Buddha who stands up to give a talk, and I don't have a flower here, so I could hold up to be like a flower. It holds up a flower, twirls it, and Maya Kashapa, in this huge gathering of people, smiles. It's as if just that act of holding the flower flowered in Maya Kasha's heart, Maya Kashapa's heart. It doesn't always, sometimes we say things and we hear talks, we hear things. That line that Roshi said in that Dharma talk, for some reason, it took root in me. The conditions were such that it took root. At another moment, wouldn't at all. I don't even remember the rest of what she said in that Dharma talk. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes people come to us and say, "Oh, you said this to me once, and this is what happened for me." And I don't remember it, but it doesn't matter. What matters is that that person, for them, that took root and it flowered for them. I also should mention, I should say that I don't sit here and talk so that things will flower for you. If I do that, then I will only be disappointed, and you will too. I come and I let go, and I see what arises. And then I share that with you. I'm actually demonstrating what the method is. Sitting in absolute, we have this koan, sitting in absolute stillness, mind flower. Unmoved, like still water, or something like that. That's it, So that's the method. What happens? Who knows? And if we can fully take to heart that who knows, well, then the world is a beautiful place. In my experience, let's say. And through generations and generations and generations of people who have come before us on this path, and numberless people who I've encountered on this path. Going through 20 years of photos for our party on Saturday night, there's so many people that have crossed this path with us, who have walked this path with us. And even if I haven't seen them for many, many years, I feel that they're still with me on this path, with us on this path. And part of that gladness too comes from recognizing that we are one body. That's why those people who have crossed our paths and have gone on to another path are still here, because we're all one. It's a one body. And even the people who aren't in the pictures, who never came to a Zen retreat, it's all one body. I read this morning a story of from 1956, Moshe Dayan, who was the head of the general of the Israeli army, was invited in 1956 to a wedding of four couples at a kibbutz that had been founded 3 years before. And it so happened that we were talking about this because it's one of the kibbutz that was attacked on October 7th last year. And he came the day of the wedding when he's accepted to come to the wedding because he knew one of the couples. And the morning of the day he was supposed to come, the horse of one of the members of the kibbutz who was charged with guarding or keeping an eye on the border with Gaza, which already at the time was a thing, right? It was a refugee camp, Gaza, at that time. And the horse came back without the rider, which meant that the rider had been killed. So Moshe Dayan accepted to come anyway, but he insisted that there not be any festivities around the wedding, that he would give a what do you call that, an oration for the funeral of the guy who had died, and he would speak at the weddings, but no festivities. So in his talk that he gave, he said, and this was absolutely, he was seeing into the future. He said, we should not doubt where the hatred for us and the violence that results comes from. We must see that we have built our paradise only a kilometer or so away from a sewer of desperation and desolation. We must not forget that, right? Well, here we are. How many years later? 60, 62, so no, almost 70 years later. Same situation, right? And he gave the Israeli government, Ben Gurion, who was the president at the time, asked Moshe Dayan to censor that from his discourse when it was going to be played on the radio. And many people were very upset with him for saying that. And he called the name of his discourse that day "At the Gates of Gaza." We're still there, right? And that's just, we're just pointing to one of the issues that face us today, which is the same basic issue of all of the issues that face us, which is this failure to see the oneness, this failure to see the one body, and to act from that place. And our practice is about that. It's about sitting down, letting go of fixed ideas about ourselves and others. When we can do that, then bear witness to what is there, what arises, and then act from that place of oneness, wholeness, something like that. And the Buddha's message, as we've seen in our study group to some extent, was that he connected internal liberation, so our individual liberations from our attachment to self and our failure to see the oneness, to see only separation. He connected that with liberation from the systems of oppression or the greater good. It wasn't just an individual liberation, something like that. So look at that. Maybe you'll be inspired to look into what is this gladness that I'm talking, that she's talking about, Of course, you can look for it, but the more you look for it, the farther away you go from it. So maybe just sit and see what arises. That's the method, something like that. Because ours is a faith, is not a faith-based spirituality. No. It's a experience-based spirituality. But even, what we call the faith-based, terror is not the way of Islam. And war is not the way of Judaism. That's not the message. That's not the point of those spiritualities. It's when we start, making beliefs firm and become stuck, then, then we can legitimize terror and war and violence and that. So it's really about staying present to what is without fixed opinions, which is what our basic sitting Zen practice is about. So maybe I will stop there. That's a lot of words, and I'm sure some of you have things to say, and I would love to hear it. Or maybe you don't, and then we can listen to that as well, because that's also very powerful. Silence. That, I think it's Krishnamurti who said, stillness answers every question. Krisha.
Good evening, everyone. I'm ruining the silent stillness. But...
There's something strange with your sound, Krisha.
Oh, I'm do you listen?
There's an echo.
That good now? No.
Do you have some other machine on, or
There's a big noise in the building. I went twice, but it's not here. I think it's downstairs. It looks like they are doing something, but they are on the move. But can you hear me? No.
Yeah, we hear you, but it's like in an echo chamber. But we can hear you. Yeah.
I was saying I am ruining our silent stillness after you talked, but I felt it. Thank you, Roshi, for your Dharma talk. I feel very grateful about it. I love these Dharma talks, that it looks like we really dive into the practice. I don't know, but I was really noticing it. Thank you for it. And about the koan that you invited us to look. I think, not in everything, but personally, it's what I like so much about Zen practice. Not good with words. Maybe I will think of joy, some gladness, and how I experience it. It's like I own myself much more. It's like, for example, today I had a big fight with the father of my kids about financial and light products, money, your part, my part, whatever. It was a pain in the ass, and but now I've been meditating for a while. And what happens is I'm completely able to say what I have to say, being true to myself. It's like I own it. I'm not afraid. I don't get too much reactive. I don't get completely blown out about the consequences, whatever. It feels like there's a kind of stillness and happiness or joy just because you are able, in my case, me, I'm able to deal with whatever is coming up in my day, and it can be quite not pleasant, and it's good. And it's something I experience a lot when I'm good in meditating with a good routine. But I love it. I like it very much. I think it feels like wisdom. It feels like I open myself to own me as a human being. And human beings, it's a lot about good things and bad things in a simple way. Emotions, good emotions, bad emotions, or we think they are good, they are bad, but they are owned. They are not out of control. And it's very good, basically. Although this is not true for every part of my life. There's still a part that I cannot, the wisdom doesn't, well, it is what it is. But this is what I wanted to share. Thank you. Oh, and I would like to know, how much time did you practice? For how long did you practice when you made your Jukai?
About a year and a half.
Okay. I don't know why I thought you practiced for a lot.
Before I did my Jukai? No.
Yeah. For about 10 years, or I got these.
It seemed like a lot, but it wasn't.
Thank you.
Marjolaine.
Yes. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for your talk. I think the gladness I sometimes experience it, especially during retreats. But what I wanted to share is how your story of Moshe Dayan and situation in that part of the world touched me a lot, because I have a lot of difficulties in not judging, not thinking in terms of the good ones and the bad ones, and trying not to have a very fixed opinion on things. It was good to hear that even Moshe Dayan somewhere, his way he talked about karma in a certain way. Situation is what it is because of things that have been done before, the way things developed and so on. I have a tendency, for the last year, 2 years maybe, not to go too deeply into news, to read papers and so on. I still do it more or less, but superficially, because makes me so often feel so bad, worried and angry sometimes, and it's difficult to handle. And this, what you said about the situation there, and how you also about the different religions, and there's not any religion who teaches to kill other people, I think. So it's what people do with it that makes the war and the problems. But anyway, it helps me to find a way to maybe handle better the information we get from what happens in the world, also on the climate change and a lot of other subjects. To be more, well, take more distance and not let the emotions become too important. Just look at them. And try to be with what does to me. And I'm happy to, well, the link you made between our practice and the world and the other people and the oneness. And it's not like we're sitting on our cushion to cut ourselves off and feel good with ourselves. It's really about being one with everything that happens around us. So thank you.
Yes, thank you. Someone was telling me this afternoon that the region, the middle, what we call the Middle East, for like 10, 15 centuries before Buddha, before Christ, before Buddha, and Buddha was 500 years before Christ, there were flourishing civilizations throughout the region, Egypt, Babylon, throughout what we call Greece, all flourishing civilizations, and for the most part they got along. However, then they did have alliances between them to fight other people and things like that, and there were empires, and then eventually at some point it apparently, it's similar to what it happens in the world today. There was climate change, there were natural disasters, there was a great drought that lasted 3 centuries, and many of these empires collapsed and whatever. And he said, what's interesting is that in what is now what we call North America, there were no empires. There's no trace of any empires there. And it's not that there were no people, but it's that the people, the indigenous people, were nomads. And so they were not claiming a piece of land. They were not claiming a specific place. They, as we know from the American Indigenous people, they saw themselves as the earth was their mother. The animals were their brothers. They had a very different relationship with the world than what was happening in where these empires were being built. It doesn't mean that one is better than the other, but it's just an interesting reflection to see what where empire building comes from. And if we can connect more with what those indigenous people were feeling in North America of the oneness of the universe, and we are just in one aspect of it, then that changes how we relate with one another and how we relate with the universe, something like that.
I was thinking about what you said about our failure to be aware of the one body, or that we are all one, or that we can be the same as the one that it's just right in front of us. To really be aware of this is something I've been, it's been around me lately. I get a bit emotional because lately I had these situations in the street. It's lately, this late 4 or 5 years here in the city, but especially in neighborhood, my neighborhood and neighborhood around, more and more people live in the streets, sleep in the streets. Really, it's really augmented the quantity of people, and the drug problem is racing. And I had some situations, like for instance, once I was parking my car, and there's usually downtown people asking for money when you park your car, just to help you park. And but well, this always this difficult situation of knowing how to help, or if to help, because sometimes and these people are drugged and they're violent, and so it's always like a situation where you have to evaluate how much you get exposed or to help, or you just go, or even if that's what you don't want to do. And yesterday I was walking down the street, and usually these people living in the street, mostly they're men, but yesterday there was a woman lying in the street, and I was maybe because she was a woman, I was more, I felt more related, or I identified more with her. And these situations, I don't know where I'm going, but it's just to say that these situations are always putting me in the limit of this awareness of the failure to be aware of the one body, like the not being able to get close to these people and help, mostly because often because of social structures or how do I help? Like, what do I do? I mean, do I give some food to this person? It just doesn't solve anything. It's just one food. Maybe you just makes this person a little bit better in a whole life of. Anyway, this is just a reflection with no end. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sure this resonates with everyone in different ways. Because we all have these questions, what to do, how, or how much are we willing to open and see and feel? And that's what this practice is really about. It's opening more and more. And then when we, because as you point out, we have these social conventions about what we should do or shouldn't do, or ideas about, oh, well, if I do this, that doesn't really solve anything because it's just one meal. Or if I give a blanket, well, then someone will steal the blanket. Or if I give money, the person will buy drugs. Or, you know, we have all these things that we chatter about to ourselves. And then we just don't do anything because it's too much. Which may be a legitimate response. It's not that might be appropriate to do nothing. At the same time, you know, I witnessed a thing the other day in the street where there was an old guy who, I don't know, I guess he stopped someone and asked for money or something. And this woman had just bought groceries with her small children, and she took out some bananas and she said, "Would you like some bananas?" And the guy took it. And then another guy was walking by and he too had this crate of food. And he said, "Do you want some celery?" Because that just was on the top of his crate of food. He said, "Do you want some celery?" So that's not going to solve the guy's fundamental hunger and lack and dire situation, probably. However, that does mean that he will have some food in that moment. We respond where we are and what we have to offer. We can always offer something, even if it's just a smile or concern. There's a woman who I see in my neighborhood who sometimes is sitting at the bus stop, sometimes she's walking around. I see her in different places. It's an old woman, and I'm pretty sure she doesn't really have anywhere to go, and she's not waiting for the bus. I think it's that she doesn't want to be home alone, so she comes out to see people, you know, to be in the world. That's really my deep sense of what it is. And I've tried to meet her eyes and say something to her or smile or something. She won't look. So it's okay. You know, I won't force her to look at me, and I won't force her to have an interaction with me. My openness and my willingness to interact with her is there. And at some point, maybe it will happen, you know? I would be happy to just sit down at the bus stop and talk with her. Because I really do think that's what it is. And she probably doesn't have any money to sit at the cafe and have a coffee. And She just doesn't want to be alone, I think. So we respond however we can. We have to drop our ideas about what the person needs. Maybe she just does, she doesn't look at me because she doesn't want to talk. You know, clearly she doesn't want to talk, but that's okay. You know, I drop my idea, what she needs. I don't know. And I also drop my ideas about what I should do or shouldn't do and just stay with the situation. And when we talk about the one body, we also, as Bernie Glassman taught us at Auschwitz, we go to Auschwitz not for a history lesson. We go to Auschwitz because to experience the one body, that we are the victims, the perpetrators, and those who are coming there to explore that. We are all of that. And that's truly what happens. And that changes then our experience there when we realize that we too have that potential and probably have done that, excluded people, ignored people, mistreated people, mistreated ourselves, parts of ourselves, you know, that we don't want to see, that we think are not good. So then we exterminate it. And that brings us to great suffering. And become recognizing the one body brings us to great gladness. So maybe I will end there because time is up. Thank you, everyone, for your sharing.